This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They even refused food and aid offered by commercial vessels that sped to assist them before we got there, he said. That's how headstrong they were in their bid to reach Italy.
That's Nikos Alexiou, a spokesman for the Greek Coast Guard on the capsized boat loaded with migrants. Details coming up. Also, the governor of Sudan's West Darfur state was killed yesterday, and a parliamentary committee in Zimbabwe says the new nomination fees for candidates in the August election will stand. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. At least 78 migrants have drowned and hundreds more remain missing and feared dead after their battered and overloaded boat capsized off the coast of Greece. Just over 100 migrants have been rescued and a massive operation to find more continues. Events raise the question, though, of whether the tragedy, the worst in recent years, could have been averted. Anti Karsava reports from Athens.
Six Coast Guard vessels, a military helicopter, and a Navy frigate continue to comb the site of the tragedy, some 50 miles south of Pylos in southeast Greece. Hopes, though, are fading. So far, 104 migrants have been recovered, all of them men, the majority from Egypt, Syria, Pakistan, and the Palestinian territories. It remains unclear how many people were on board the battered 30-meter fishing boat, but initial accounts from survivors put the number to as many as 750. Worst yet, 100 of them, women and children, were said to have been kept below deck, where smugglers are known to keep them locked in perilous journeys to the west. The causes of the tragedy are being investigated, but on Thursday, authorities here said the boat was left drifting across the Mediterranean shortly after it set sail from Libya, bound for Italy. Nikos Alexiou, a spokesman for the Greek Coast Guard, explains. At some point in the early phase of the journey, the boat lost its engine, he says. Because it was overloaded, movement of people on deck appears to have caused it to tip over and capsize. Alexiou said the Coast Guard made several attempts to contact and approach the vessel before the tragedy, but any and every bid was rebuffed. They even refused food and aid offered by commercial vessels that sped to assist them before we got there, he said. That's how headstrong they were in their bid to reach Italy. Since coming to power 4 years ago, the conservative Greek government of Kyriakos Mitsotakis has enforced tighter migration controls. Alexiou dismissed allegations that the tragedy could have been averted. Had we forcibly intervened and tried to haul the vessel to safe waters, an even greater tragedy would have followed. Greece, he said, would have then been blamed for causing the tragedy. Instead, Alexiou said, Greek Coast Guard opted to watch. And if they had not been close enough to act as fast as they did, he said, the tragedy might have been worse, with the number of survivors significantly less. European Union officials have expressed sadness, as they put it, over the tragedy, but called for more united strategy to combat migrant smugglers. Human rights groups say the crackdown would simply force more migrants to seek more perilous routes to reach the West. The United Nations says more than 70,000 refugees have arrived so far in Europe's frontline Mediterranean countries, including Greece, Italy, Spain, and Cyprus this year. Nearly 1,000 people are estimated to have died or gone missing in the Mediterranean this year alone. Anthika Rasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
The governor of Sudan's West Darfur state, Karamis Abdul Abakar, was killed yesterday after claiming the paramilitary rapid support forces RSF and allied militias were committing genocide against civilians in the state capital, Jenina. Sudan's army chief, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, blamed the killing on the RSF, which has been battling the army for dominance for 2 months. The RSF has condemned the attack on Abakar, but what it's called outlaws, working with the Sudanese military intelligence amid continuing tribal conflict in West Darfur. Nabil Biagio reached Saleh Mohamud, the president of the Darfur Bar Association, to shed more light on the situation in West Darfur.
Conflict is not new in Darfur. The conflict started in 2003 and is still continuing. This conflict resulted also in crimes of genocide and crimes against humanity. I think this recent escalation is also a continuation of the historical conflict between ethnic groups, indigenous groups, the Masali, and Arabs, local and those coming from outside the country. This incident of the killing of or assassination of the Wali itself, even the Rapid Support Force has also released a statement saying that they are not involved. They are not involved in this killing. And then this is why we think it's important.
They blame it, on rogue elements. They said rogue elements. Elements that are
exactly,
out of control.
Exactly, because I think the situation, the environment there is very complicated and very chaotic. There is always a possibility that factions who are definitely very much a tribal can also be accused of being implicated in the commission of these crimes. It is about land. This conflict is about land. And then so many elements, so many people are blamed. First of all, the central government is responsible for what is happening there for more than since the signing of the Juba Agreement. And after that, there was a decision from the government of Sudan about the necessity of the exit of UNAMID without even talking about the credible alternative to assume the responsibility of protection of the people. Number two, the presence of the army garrison there in Jenina is also responsible because they are very passive. They are passive. They don't take a step to defend anybody there when crimes occur and they don't intervene to protect their lives. I think they are involved in this. Again, the other issue of importance is that after the signing of the Juba Agreement and the exit of the UNAMID, there was a plan saying that there should be deployment of collective armies belonging to the rebel movements, the government, and the Rapid Support Force to replace UNAMID. This never happened. There is a vacuum. There is a situation where there is lawlessness. There is no rule of law, no police, there's no criminal courts, I think, judges, and it is a complete chaotic situation where absence of the rule of law is one of the basic elements that is encouraging potential criminals to continue committing crimes without being accountable for their acts.
How did the conflict, which started in Khartoum between the army and the Rapid Support Forces, reignited the old conflict in Darfur that happened in 2003, which was, waged on an ethnic basis. Even the United Nations representative in Sudan, Volker Perthes, admitted that the violence that's going on in Al Jenina right now has an ethnic dimension.
You correctly mentioned the statement of the representative of the UN Secretary General, Mr. Guterres, here, Mr. Volker, describing the nature of the conflict there. But the situation that erupted in Khartoum definitely is affecting other parts of the Sudan. Now, immensely, it affected Darfur, first of all, because all the five states are witnessing and experiencing a conflict which is continuing today. You can go back and see what is happening right now in Alfasha, in Kutum, Nayala, Dalinji, and Algenen, of course. So it is a direct and immediate consequence of the situation in Khartoum that led to the escalation, as you mentioned. Again, Darfur is very fragile. We have a situation where the SAF, that is Sudanese Army, and the Rapid Support Force are main targets to the conflict everywhere in the five states of Darfur. Then we have the additional dimension of ethnic tribal conflict that is continuing since 2003.
That's Saleh Mahmoud, president of the Darfur Bar Association, speaking with VOA's Nabil Biagio from the Sudanese town of Wad Madani. Medical aid group Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says about 6,000 people have fled El Janina, the capital of Sudan's West Darfur state, and taken refuge in the Chadian town of Adre over the past few days. MSF said today the newly arrived refugees join more than 100,000 others who have sought safety in eastern Chad since Sudan's conflict began in mid-April. Analysts say the international community is reluctant to put pressure on Chad's government to transition to civilian rule. In this report from N'Djamena, reporter Henry Wilkins speaks to one man arrested during protests against the junta and local politicians who say civilians need political representation to air their grievances against the state.
General Mohamed Idriss Deby seized control of Chad in 2021. His father, the previous president, had just been killed during an attempt by state forces to put down a group of rebels in the north. Altogether, the Deby family's junta has ruled Chad for almost 33 years. And while an agreement was made in August last year to transition to civilian rule, experts say progress towards fulfilling the terms has been patchy. Dejona Avakzuma, the leader of the opposition Democratic Party, said he thinks citizens are losing patience and need political representation to air their grievances. He says everyone is waiting for the day when the anger starts to take hold of the general population. He thinks he's not being too pessimistic in saying he thinks it could happen, since there is no safety valve. In October, protesters took to the streets of N'Djamena, the capital. Around 70 were shot dead when the military opened fire on the crowds, while hundreds more were arrested. One man who said he was not a protester but was mistakenly arrested in an area of N'Djamena where protests were taking place asked VOA to withhold his identity for fear of government reprisals. He claims he was taken to an infamous penal colony in the Sahara Desert known as Koro Toro.
On a filé toute la nuit.
He says he was driven through the night, reaching the prison at around 4 a.m. He says the person under him in the truck was dead by the time they arrived. He says it was horrific, with people dying from thirst and hunger en route. The man VOA spoke to was recently released, along with around 700 others, after a presidential pardon for October's protesters. Chad is one of the poorest countries in the world and has played an important part in international efforts to quell an insurgency of terrorists linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda in Africa's Sahel region, allying closely with France in particular. Some experts say this means the international community is reluctant to put pressure on Deby to transition to civilian rule. One analyst thinks there is not much the international community can do to force a transition to civilian rule, however. Michael Shirkin is with 14 North Strategies, a Washington-based consultancy.
The reality is that there's only so much they can do short of intervening in the political affairs of another country, which, despite allegations of neocolonialism that are routinely thrown at the United States and France, the reality is that the U.S. and France don't like to be that, don't want to be doing that.
Aside from Chad's rebellion in the north, in the south, there has been a recent flare-up of violence between herder and sedentary farmer communities, a common cause of instability across the Sahel region. One herder community leader in Western Chad told VOA the government has been ineffective in keeping farmers off land designated for herder use. Ibrahim Alifa Mayana is a herder community leader in the town of Dabali. He says if the farmers don't leave, there's no solution to the problem. He says the government told the herders they would move the farmers off the land designated for the cattle, but that hasn't happened. Instead, the farmers have built homes on the land. Analysts think violence is likely to spread from Sudan to Chad's eastern border region, but many also worry that with such a delicate balance of power, it could threaten to engulf the entire country unless more is done to address popular grievances. Chad's Minister for Reconciliation is yet to respond to a request for comment. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, N'Djamena, Chad.
You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has urged Tunisia to agree to IMF reforms and avoid falling off an economic cliff after the European Union offered a $1 billion aid package contingent on the country reaching an IMF deal as well as an immediate €150 million in financial support. But some Tunisian opposition figures worried that the U.S. and the EU are extending what they call a power grab by Tunisian President Kais Saied. Ahmed Galoul, former Tunisian Minister of Youth and Sports, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about those concerns.
I think the United States has a major role in supporting democracy, not only in Tunisia, but around the world, especially during this very hard time where the Western values of democracy are being challenged, whether by China or by Russia, through the war in Ukraine. So the West, mainly the United States, which is leading the West, needs to show the world that it is indeed standing by its liberal democratic values. What is needed in Tunisia is that people of Tunisia who are aspiring for a free public sphere and democratic transition, a stronger democracy, is that they need to see a stronger stance from the United States in standing by democracy, refusing and rejecting any actions that are leading to the strengthening of the grab of power from a populist dictator who is Mr. Kais Saied himself.
The European Union, the IMF, and the World Bank have their own leverage to pressure the Tunisian president to correct his path toward autocracy. What could these international players do to stop the backsliding away from democratic norms in Tunisia?
I mean, the same which applies for the United States, it applies for the European Union. And we need to say it, that Kais Saied has been allowed for more than a year and a half to strengthen his grip on power and to monopolize all institutions of powers. The West, Europe, and the United States have asked Kais Saied to give them a roadmap. They were, and we think they must be aware, that the roadmap which Kais Saied has given them is a roadmap for him to have a stronger grip over power, not to return to democracy. So I think whether they did not really believe that it is possible for an Arab country to actually have a democracy. From our side, we do believe that we need to continue our peaceful struggle to regain our democracy, to build a stronger democracy, and to show our partners in the West. And we do believe that Tunisia is a partner to the West, to show them that indeed we are worthy of being free within a democratic system.
But Tunisia became a hub for migration to Europe, and that scares the European Union to do any punitive actions against Kais Saied. What do you make of that?
I mean, the Europeans have tried this policy during the time of Ben Ali. They know that such a policy, meaning stability under dictatorship, does not really secure any stability. Europeans do actually know that the rise of the level of illegal immigration has happened during the time of Qais Saied. It was not the case during the time of the democratic process and transition. It is true that straight afterward the revolution, there was a rise in illegal immigration and maybe of violence. But then things have settled down. So a democratic process and democratic state is the actual answer to their fears. For them not to have this wave of illegal immigrant, they need to have a democratic state, because sending back legal immigrants to Tunisia and basically throwing them to the desert or sometime in a criminal action, killing them at the sea, is not the actual answer. It is only such actions and policies are only incitements for further crimes.
That was Ahmed Galoul, former Tunisian Minister of Youth and Sports, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi. Tanzania's government is encouraging drivers to switch from putting gasoline in their tanks to compressed natural gas. This initiative aims to lower carbon emissions that cause global warming. As Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam, some drivers are also hoping the switch will save them money in the long run.
Jackson Peter, an Uber driver based in Dar es Salaam, recently switched from using gasoline to compressed natural gas, CNG, in his car. He says he did it for the environment and his wallet. I noticed that fuel prices were rising, and I didn't know until when the prices would continue to rise. Also, using gas is less expensive and better for the environment compared to petrol and diesel. It costs at least $1,000 to convert a car to compressed natural gas in Tanzania. It's a price many car users find more affordable, even though the government does not subsidize the charge. The Tanzanian government aims to power 8,000 cars with natural gas in Dar es Salaam alone. Officials say so far more than 2,000 vehicles have made the switch since the initiative began in 2018. At the conversion center located at the Dar es Salaam Institute of Technology, there's a steady stream of customers. Workshop manager Gerutu Bosige explains. He says with the increasing awareness and education about natural gas usage in Tanzania, the number of customers has grown rapidly from one to thousands. He projects there will be over 6,000 customers by 2025, reflecting the positive response as more Tanzanians embrace the benefits of using natural gas in vehicles. The Tanzanian government has embraced the 2015 Paris Agreement to limit global warming, mitigate the impacts of climate change, and build an environmentally sustainable future. Jamal Baruti sits on Tanzania's National Environment Council. Between now and 2030, he says, the aim of Tanzania is to make sure the amount of hazardous gases emission is reduced by up to 30 to 35% compared to the assessment that was conducted previously. He says, we know these gases come from various areas, including the burning of forests, charcoal and cars. So with this trend of using natural gas in our country, we believe we'll reduce the emission of these gases to that extent. Besides encouraging cars to switch to CNG, the government has banned the use of firewood and charcoal by private and government institutions beginning in 2025. The government is also shifting investments to alternative energy sources, including solar energy, geothermal power, wind energy, and hydropower. Meanwhile, Jackson is confident his switch to CNG will pay off, anticipating significant profits while prioritizing environmental conservation. Charles Kombe, for VOA News, in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Audrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.